Welcome back, one and all, Parish of the Patriots, episode number 296. Yes, we are closing in on 300. I feel like I should do something special for 300, but every show is special, so it will be special in and of its own right. If you are new, most of you are return members of the congregation, so you already know, but if it's your first time listening, welcome aboard. Please stay with me through the whole show. We do have a Christian-specific segment very roughly in the halfway mark of the show. I set it off separate in case you just makes you hearing about Jesus makes you spurg out and you can't stand it. You can rest assured I'm guarding your sensitive feelings. But even if you're a non-believer, you might give it a listen. I do encourage it. But regardless, we do have the Christian specific segment, the sermon, if you would. That's roughly the halfway mark of the show. Like I say, it's very roughly. Sometimes it's going to be way earlier, sometimes a little later. But I try to aim for that halfway mark. If you do get something out of the show, don't be shy. Pay those tithes. We pass the offering plate around. You know, right here on the description page for this show on Radio Albion, we have the ultimate privacy coin. It doesn't require the blockchain. It requires a stamp. We have snail mails right there. Figure it out. It is appreciated. We don't spend a lot of time. Don't spend a lot of time begging for money. The Lord provides in all sorts of ways, and that's the way I come at it. So with that having been said, listener supporter mailbag time. This won't take long. Grand Junction. No, but I did want you to know Grand Junction. It did come through. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do my Elvis impression.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. P. Mr. T done got demoted to Mr. P. No, Mr. P. Mr. T. I'm rapping on the second cup of coffee. Got a little ahead of myself. Got a little tongue-tied. Mr. T, GPD, so blessed I can help you. Thank you, Mr. T. It's always good to hear from all of you. Do appreciate it. That wraps our listeners. See, I told you I don't spend a lot of time. I don't spend a lot of time fundraising. We get in, we get out, we keep going. Of course, it's Tuesday. And this is one of those rare occasions where I am actually recording the show on the day of the show. And you know what today is in America? It's the day the people decide. They promote this. It's all over the TV. All the media has this all these variations of the same.
2024, voters decide.
Watch our coverage. America decides 2024.
They just keep on promoting like what the hell the voters want matters.
As if they got to keep selling it.
Now, I'm not going to wade off into why I'm not going to be going to the polls. It's pretty well known. Dr. Johnson had a very good show last week, I believe, on why he doesn't vote. You can listen to that, and that pretty much sums up my position as well. If voting, you're voting for, you're on whatever level. This is my view. Y'all do your. I'm not running you down if you decide to go vote. I really not. It's, you know, you do you. But for me, voting, you're basically saying that the system has a certain amount of legitimacy that by so cat. And I read an article, an opinion piece this morning by somebody who was making the old point that I've heard my entire life about why you need to vote for the lesser of two evils. Why? Sure. But this other one will be really a whole lot worse. But you see, you're propping up the system. A really good example of this is what happened in the UK this year, which is the Tories got blown out. BTFO'd. Now, I read an article just the other day that the Labour Prime Minister is already polling lower than the Tory Prime Minister got booted out. And the part the media doesn't tell is the Labour Party didn't blow out the Tories because everybody in Britain woke up one day and said, we've changed our mind. We really like Labour's policies. It's just that the Tories had run out of so much legitimacy that people were like, there's no point in voting for these guys because they never do any of the stuff they say they're going to do. They stayed home And so Labor got in there, and now it's just a matter of a few months, and the Labor Party has no legitimacy either. Your non-voting also sends a message. Now, again, this is my point of view, and I'm not saying you should morally go do this or that, or you're an idiot if you vote. It's everybody's decision. But for me, personally, this is why. I'm done. I view this system as completely, seeing the media running around with America decide, voters decide. It's all just silly. It's funny, I read a piece, an opinion piece the other day, and they were warning. Oh, it was such a tumultuous election system, a tumultuous election cycle. The people, the media that sits around and wrings their hands about the tumultuous, election cycle, they're the ones constantly stirring up the tumult. But nevertheless, this opinion piece says, this could, oh my gosh, if this goes off the rails, it could even end up in secession. You could wind up with, and I'm sitting here going, I wish in my dreams. That's where I hope it goes. See, that's what I am for. I am all about secession. You see, breaking the country up into smaller nations, into smaller countries. It's the best outcome. You see, smaller countries are limited on being able to go around the world meddling in other people's business. Smaller countries, by their very nature, have to learn to get along with other countries. It tends to make people a little better behaved for the most part. I laugh when I see people, I read people, wringing their hands about, oh my gosh, how awful it would be if America were to break up. I mean, why do people view that as a terrible outcome? I mean, what is it that you're getting out of this system now? Mostly it seems to come down to fear. They're just afraid of the unknown, afraid to try something different. I think that's that just seems to be the default position for most people. They're just afraid of change. They're afraid of something new. But once at some point in time, you got to look around at your surroundings and say, well, this is really shitty. We got to try something different. Amazing me, people complain endlessly about the system we're under, about the government and whatnot. But yet, if you say, yeah, we need to break up into separate countries and try something different, they'll run backwards. It's just too scary. What is it you're wanting to hold together? Endless wars all over the planet. I mean, exactly what are we getting out of that? Crumbling infrastructure. What are we getting here? Nonstop gay anal and all of the rest of it. I mean, what do you support? What are you so desperate to keep this thing together for? Main thing I'm looking forward to is the robocall stopping and not having to see these stupid campaign ads. It's insulting. I'm not even talking about presidential. I haven't seen a single Trump ad in Texas, by the way. I guess they figure Texas is in the bag. We're not a battleground state. I haven't seen a single Trump ad. I've seen plenty of Ted Cruz ads. This is what I mean. Ted Cruz. This is supposed to be your choice. This is supposed to be the lesser of two evils. Better off with Ted Cruz than Colin Allred. But what the hell has Ted Cruz actually done? As I've told y'all multiple times, Ted Cruz's campaign ads have mostly been about how he wants to protect women's sports from transgenders. That's really important. Well, he's got a new ad he's been running for the past couple of weeks, and he supported some act, to crack down on people making fake porn. And he's got some teenage girl on there. Apparently her classmates made fake porn, I guess put her face on a porn star's body. So I don't know. I don't care. These ads stay muted while they're on. I just look up once in a while and shake my head. He's protecting teen girls from having AI-generated porn made about them. The world is burning around us. Our infrastructure is crumbling. We live under a completely corrupt regime. And I'm supposed to worry about some teenage girl that her classmates made AI porn. I'm sure that sucks for her, but that's really not a a big concern for me. I'm sorry. Trannies in women's sports, I don't really care. I don't care about women's sports, period. I actually don't care about men's sports either. And this is what I'm supposed to be concerned about. This is why Amanda the robocall continually calls my phone reminding me to go vote for Ted Cruz, because this is the most important election ever, because I've got to stop AI porn and trannies in women's sports. It's a clown show. Who's going to win? Is it going to go into overtime? I was just still, you know, I've mentioned it before, and I talked about it on yesterday's Daily Nationalist. You know, Americans view these things as a sports ball game. Is the election going to go into overtime before we find out which team wins? I think, you know, if Trump wins, and again, it's so silly, you know, the fraud in 2020 was so in your face. I mean, it was just blatant. We all saw the videos throwing the election observers out and putting boards on the windows so you couldn't even look in to see them doing their fraud. And they're like, oh, we did that because of COVID. And the media says anybody that says otherwise is a conspiracy theory threat to our democracy. So on and so forth. We saw it. We saw them unload. We had videos of people sitting there filling out ballots and putting them in the box. You see the blatant fraud. And all these people now running around talking about how we got to get out there and vote harder because of the fraud. Well, if we vote hard enough, they can't trick us. Enough already. Just give up. I want to say give up. But seriously, just accept the fact that the system is illegitimate. Is Trump going to win? I think there's a good possibility he's going to quote unquote win. Now people point out, yeah, because he's promising to fight even more wars for Israel. That's a part of it. I think another aspect, though, that gets missed is after the blatant, you know, they'll push this stuff down your throat. Like we did child trannies, for instance, and they shoved that. It's like every news cycle they were shoving child trannies down our throats. And then like people started getting fed up with it and they kind of rolled that back a little bit. They dialed it back down. You see, I think it's kind of like that. You know, the fraud in 2020 was so ridiculous and so in your face that I think on a certain level, it's kind of like they've got to keep people buying into the system. You know, if it's that blatant again, then perhaps people like in the UK, because remember, all of it's connected. You know, when I believe that they looked at these election results in the UK where people just said, I'm not bothering voting because these stupid Tories are no different than the Labour Party anyway. Why am I taking part? See, this is a real danger. See, my not voting is a vote in and of itself. It's a vote against the system that we live under. I think they're probably a little worried about that. If they have cases where people are videoing throwing out the election observers and putting boards up on the windows, again, at some point, even those that are in the strongest amount of denial are going to have a hard time going, we got to get out and vote harder next year. Let's get out the vote. Let's put up more campaign signs. We got to make America great again or whatever the hell. So they got to keep people buying into the system. So I think if Trump is allowed to win, because I mean, if they just had a fair election, obviously he's going to win. Harris couldn't pull 1% in the Democrat primary. Nobody likes this woman. Just like nobody liked Hillary either. But she had more of a support base than Kamala Harris. Kamala Harris is just a meme candidate. Anyway, if Trump wins, I think a part of this is going to be because they're trying to keep people buying into the system. If Trump wins, then it's as much about the next election cycle that comes around. People will say, see, we got out the vote last time and Trump got in there. See, we won. It's going to be as much or even more about keeping people buying into this system as anything else. In a lot of ways, if they were to go hard, and I don't think they will, but if they were to go as hard on the election fraud this time as they did in 2020, even people that are in clinging on to the most staunch amount of denial of reality would have to finally throw their hands up and say there's no point. Now, I don't think that equates to people going out on the street with their guns and taking back America. It means people are just going to quit participating. And people not participating goes beyond just not voting. It means people just stop complying with lots of things. One of the founding things that keeps the country moving forward is white people's obsession with following all of the rules. And they keep people following all of the rules and things keep grinding forward. If white people ever break free of that and stop following all of the rules, because a lot of the rules you can ignore and find out that, you know, it doesn't really matter. And then that builds one upon the other and the system breaks down. Yeah, I think there's a push. I think there will be a push to keep people locked into the system. If Trump wins, then that means next election cycle, people say, we did it last time. See, we can keep buying into this system. Be interesting. If they do the blatant fraud that they did last time, that's, I don't know. I want to say that's the end of people buying into the system. But people, I don't underestimate people's gullibility, people desperately clinging on to the status quo. But it would be interesting. Because Trump, as I've said before, it's turned into the whole Trump support thing has turned into a bit of a personality. Well, not a bit of. It is. It's a personality cult. And I get it. But let's just say, hypothetically, they do blatant fraud again and tell you everybody wants Kamala Harris. Just like everybody wanted Joe Biden, who didn't even campaign, basically. And they do this again. And okay, how are you going to get people buying into the next election in 4 years? I mean, they're going to run Trump again in 4 years. So now you don't even have people buying in because of the personality cult. You're going to run some Bush again? You're going to run a Bush? Maybe Ted Cruz can make a stab at it. He can run his campaign in 4 years on protecting women's sports or teenage girls from AI porn or whatever the hell. Are you going to whip up and get people buying into the system? Who are you even going to run? The only reason anybody's buying in this year is because of the Trump personality cult on both sides. The Trump derangement people that are convinced he's going to go door to door and drag them to a camp or something, which is mostly projection on those people's part. Or the people that, you know, Trump is their Lord and Savior on some level or another. He's playing 5D chess. The white hats are in charge, the Q cult or whatever. When you eliminate those things, what the hell is even left? And how much gas does Trump even have? He's not going to be able to run another 4 years. I mean, I guess technically he could be getting old. Imagine blatant 2020 election fraud this time around. And then in 4 years, you're trying to whip people up for Kamala Harris versus Ted Cruz or some other milquetoast, nobody cares about Republican, and expecting people. Denial only carries so far. And at some point, you're going to have a repeat of what happened in the UK. People throw their hands up and say, there's no point. These Tories are useless. The system is rigged. Now, again, for someone like me who favors the idea of secession and breaking the country up, this isn't a bad thing. It's not necessarily a bad outcome. Smaller countries make better countries, you know? I mean, you're not going to fix a system this corrupt. That's the denial a lot of these people are in. We got to save America that we once knew when it's already long dead and gone and the corpse is stinking. We're just looking at the buzzards picking the last bones off. Look at the financials, for goodness sake. It's going to come apart. What we should be doing is having a discussion on how we're going to get out of the other side of this. You know, either when the financial just completely implodes on itself, we're basically going to have two choices. you know, you look at the debt levels for the people themselves and now the government, because the people have been tapped out for a while now. So that's why the government's been borrowing more money. Because again, this entire system, financially speaking, is based on continually growing debt. Well, that can't go on forever. You know, for the economic system that we live under, it requires ever increasing debt. Well, the people are long since tapped out. That's why the government keeps borrowing more and more and more money, because if they do not, the whole thing implodes. They've got to create more debt. That's how they quote unquote print more money. But you run out. At some point, the government will be tapped. And then what? There's only going to be two choices. They act like they always want to make this stuff more complicated than what it is. Let me tell you, there's going to be two choices at the end of that. When that inevitability arrives, and it is closer every day that goes by, there's going to be two choices. The banks get to seize all of the assets and you will own nothing and be happy, or the banks get told, it's a bad day for you. Guess what? Everybody else is broke. You're broke too. You ain't getting no assets and you ain't getting paid. Either they allow the banks to seize all the assets and now they own everything and you own nothing, or they get stuffed and we start from scratch. Sorry, you don't get to own everything. That's the two outcomes, and that's the discussion. This is the real discussion that could be happening. Not some silliness about Trump is their last chance to save the America we know, when they're just picking the bones off the corpse. It's done. The discussion we should be having is, what are we going to wind up with? Because it's either, there's only two possible outcomes. They're going to take everything. Austerity measures, they will frame it as austerity measures. Look for them to frame it as a moral issue. We owe these banks this money. It's only right. You don't want to be an immoral person. The Bible says wicked people don't repay what's owed. And these poor bankers, just look at them. You know what? These poor bankers, they loaned this money in good faith. Or what about the credibility of the United States government? It's backed by the full faith and credit. You don't want to be a deadbeat, do you? Give all the assets to the banks. Then that just so happens to be everything. And you own nothing. But don't worry, you'll be happy in your 15-minute city, living in your pot and eating your freaking bug paste. Or you wind up with some move. Somebody has to take control. You know, that means a more of a nationalist state, whatever form that might take. This is what the banks lay awake at night fearing, not Donald Trump getting elected. That's for the plebs. That's crap their hand feeding the idiots out here. What, you know what they lay awake at night worrying about? Worrying that when this inevitable time comes, and again, it's getting here pretty soon. When that time comes, there's a push and some sort of nationalist form of government. And by that, I mean a government that has the ability to stand up and say, no, you're not getting the assets, but it's owed to us. Okay, where's your military? They don't have the power they want you to think they have. These banks are going to demand, we need these assets. You owe it to us. They don't have a way to take it. If you have a nationalist form of government, they're like, well, we say you can't, and we have men with guns. So you're not getting the assets. You can eat the loss and go away. We're going to start rebuilding. See, that's what keeps them up awake at night. You know, and understand, a nationalist government that is able to do that can take on many forms. You can't get locked into, you know, this form of government, you know, some sort of vision you have in your mind. It could take up many sorts of forms. The important part, the defining aspect of it, is a government that has the ability to stand up and tell the banks you're not getting any assets. You just made a bad investment and now you're broke. We're going to start over. While the banks whine and holler and kick and scream and demand what they owe, any government that has the ability to say, yeah, tough. That was your investment. And you went broke. Now, you're broke. You're not going to get to seize all the assets and everybody owns nothing and can just be happy with that while you own everything. In demand for payment for money that didn't even exist. You just created. They just create digits on a computer and then they're going to demand that they get all of the actual tangible things because they were owed these digits on a computer that they themselves put on the computer. What a scam. And you wind up with any form of government that says that's a scam. You're not getting it. Tough. You can demand all you want. You're not getting it. Those are the two options. And that's what the discussion should be. And that's why they're desperate to keep people buying into the system. Because you see, this system, if it's in place, the media and the government will tell everybody that they have a moral obligation to hand everything over to the banks. They have a moral obligation. We own our debt. We owe our debts. We don't want to be a bunch of deadbeats. We have to give everything to the banks in exchange for these digits on a computer that they themselves added onto the computer and invented out of thin air. They have nothing in it. They have nothing actually invested. It's none of it's real. You see, that's what keeps them. They don't want a nationalist, any form of nationalist government. And again, understand that could take many forms. You will know you've got some form of nationalist government if you have a government in place that tells the banks to go screw themselves. They're not getting the assets. Just because it doesn't look like what you fantasize or imagine what a nationalist government should look like. Any government that tells the banks, tough shit, you're not getting paid. Eat it. You're not going to, no, you don't get to own everybody's assets. No, you don't get to seize the national parks and seize everybody's houses and turn them into renters. You don't get to own everything. You're not omnipotent. You're not God. You invented numbers on a computer. Screw you. And if you keep it up, we may quit being so nice about it. If you have a government that does that, you have some form of nationalist government. Don't look for whatever visuals you invent in your mind, that's what you're looking for. The rest of it can be figured out later. If you get a, and that's what keeps them awake at night. They got to keep people buying into this system because you know what this government would do. If the day comes January 1st, 2025, regardless of who's going to wind up in the president or whatever, this system in place, you know what they're going to do. They're going to tell you, they're going to mobilize the media and the government are going to tell you, do you have a moral obligation to hand all assets over to the bankers? Because after all, it wouldn't be right for them to lose money, would it? This system is what will hand everything over to them. This system is what will allow you to own nothing and quote unquote, be happy. They've got to keep this system in place. And in so doing, they've got to keep people buying into it. They got to keep people buying into the legitimacy of it. Because again, what keeps them awake at night isn't the idea of Donald Trump winning. What keeps them awake at night is the idea of this system going away and a system that would deny them what their long-term actual goal is. That's what keeps them awake at night. We got to get into the Christian specific segment. We got to keep this show rolling. We're probably going to run late today. I feel it in my bones. We're going to run late today, but that's okay. You know what to do. Get in there, fill those pews. Let's get into this week's sermon at the Parish of the Patriots. You know, it is written, Jesus said, the truth will set you free. And it's one of those statements I find that has so much depth. You can keep, it's one of those things you can keep coming back to and finding more and more depth out of this simple statement that the truth will set you free. I was thinking about this the other day. If this is true, and surely it is, that Jesus Christ said, the truth will set you free, then the inverse of this, if you turn the coin over, that's head, you turn over and look at tail, then it stands to reason the inverse is also true, which would be the lie will enslave you. If the truth will set you free, then the lie will enslave you. Now, the lie can be many different things. Now, obviously, we live in clown world. We're flooded with lies every day. But what about other lies? What about other forms that the lie takes? I was thinking of this, and I think one of the lies that commonly we get, that we build for ourselves, is the what ifs. You know, you start thinking about something, and then you start thinking about all the what ifs. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, you're making plans and you've got to think about all the different scenarios before you move forward so that you can make an informed decision. I'm talking about when you get so bogged down in what ifs that it paralyzes you into inaction. You don't wind up not taking any action because you think, well, what if? And then if that happens, then what if this? And then what if this? And you keep building on this, never stopping to realize all of that is simply a figment of your imagination. In other words, it's not real. It's a lie. It's a lie you've invented for yourself. What may have started off as simply trying to consider all possible outcomes becomes a hindrance when you get so bogged down into the lie, so bogged down into the what ifs, that now you wind up, you don't take any action. Now, as you regular members of the congregation, listeners to the show, no, our faith is well-defined, and I plan to get into this as we go along today. I'm going to try to get in the book of Matthew, chapter 25. And we'll get into this a little further. But as you all already know, our faith is well defined for us by Jesus himself as action. So as such, if you get so bogged down in the lie, in the what ifs that you invent for yourselves, this can create a situation where you wind up, you don't take any action at all. And your faith can wind up falling flat. And just as a practical matter in your life, you don't get anywhere. What makes it hard is we want our decisions, because our life is just a series of choices, a series of decisions. And whenever we're faced with choices and decisions, we want a clear-cut one. We want, this is clearly going to lead to disaster, and this will lead to utopia. We want easy decisions. And very few, if any, are ever that simple, ever that easy. Our choices, our decisions, generally are going to wind up between two shitty choices. That's the reality. Most of the time, when you're facing a tough choice, it's because choice A will have this outcome. These are the negatives. Choice B will have this other outcome. And these are these whole different set of negatives. We want a choice. We want an option where there are no negatives. And a tough choice are usually those that there are going to be negatives regardless. And you just got to, basically, as the saying goes, you got to pick your poison. And then you sit there and just go back and forth because you're trying to find some option where there's no negatives. And a lot of times there is negatives. But you got to make a choice. You know, refusing to make a choice is a choice in and of itself. And usually the outcome of that is going to be more negative than the two that you're sitting there bogged down, you know, afraid to make a call on. Another form that the lie, because again, if the truth sets us free, the lie will enslave us. The inverse has to be true. Another form that the lie can take is denial. You've heard the saying about, you know, the different stages of grief. And this reflects fairly true, fairly accurately. And one of those stages is denial. When somebody is in denial of the reality, they've lost somebody or the situation, or they've lost their job, whatever the case may be, they have this stage of denial. Well, denial is just another lie, and it is going to enslave you because you can't move forward. People who can't overcome grief, a lot of times they're hung up in the denial stage, you know, and because they're hung up in the denial stage, they've been enslaved by this lie. Because if you're denying reality, you're inventing a lie. You're holding on to things that aren't so because you don't want them to be so. You know, you don't want to face the reality, so you keep clinging to this denial of reality this unpleasant reality. I think a clear example of this is this whole election business today. I was reading a piece this morning talking about, you know, this is our last chance to save America as we know it. And I'm like, that is long gone. This person who intellectually, you know, is usually pretty good on a lot of areas, then sits there and turns around and says, this election is our last chance to save the America we all knew. This person is clearly in denial. They've been enslaved by the lie because they don't want to face the reality. Regardless of regardless of how you feel, the America we all knew, the America we grew up with, so as to speak, and that is only if you're older. The younger people never knew that America. It's another selfish viewpoint that older generations tend to have. The America we grew up with. Well, people that are younger than you never knew it. What are you expecting them to buy into? But nevertheless, to make this statement, this is our last chance to save the America, is just denial. It's long gone. That ship has long since sailed. And yet you see this denial. And what's funny is in this person's other writings, you see where they talk about basically admitting that the ship has sailed. And then they turn around and say, we got to get out there. Got to get out there and vote. This is our last chance to save America. It's denial. Is denial just the same as somebody that throws themselves on the coffin and doesn't want to accept that their loved one is gone? No, get up, get out of there. You see them people, they get all hysterical at the funeral, be embarrassing, throwing themselves down on the grave, going, no, get up, get out of there. You can't be dead. That's denial. It's a lie. They're gone. Face it. America's gone. You got to face it. This person, if you had that view, you're enslaved. You're enslaved to a lie because you can't face reality and you're not moving forward. Now, as I propose, that if the truth sets us free, the inverse must also be true. The lie enslaves us. One of the key elements of this system that we live under is in the way it works so well. You see, a truly enslaved man. So, man, if you think of a traditional slave, outside of the American view that thinks the only slaves that ever existed were black Africans that brought in to pick cotton. Slavery is a long-time institution that existed all throughout history. People would sometimes sell themselves into slavery because of their debts and whatnot. But if you think of a slave per se, while they would be enslaved, in a lot of ways, that was the end of it. And what I mean is that person was very well aware of their station in life. Slavery didn't necessarily always mean forever. Sometimes a person would sell themselves into slavery for a period of, say, 4 years. And at the end of that 4 years, their contract would be up and they would be released. They would be free again because, you know, their debts were covered or whatever. That person would know and understand that they're a slave. I was thinking of this. The true slave, the truly enslaved person, because people sit around and say, well, I don't know why you're talking about slavery. We don't even have slavery anymore. See, Abraham Lincoln done freed the slaves. We don't have slavery anymore. And yet you look around and how else do you describe the mass of society, the people, so many of the people you look at around you, they're slaves. You see, the truly enslaved is not necessarily somebody who would be in traditional indentured servitude. No, the true slave is the man who believes he's free when he is not. This entire system, this narrative that is built up around this entire system, is that we have all this freedom. They market this to us, especially around election time, but they market this to us repeatedly. The land of the free, the home of the brave. We have this freedom in America. You see, in America, we enjoy the freedom. We have this freedom. This is a population that is truly enslaved because they don't even, they believe they're free. While they follow all these, this myriad of this just jungle, this maze of all these rules, regulations, restrictions, you know, you got to do this and you got to do that. And don't, down to if you live in a place with a homeowners association, you have to be sure your grass isn't any taller. And yes, some busybody might come by with a tape measure to see how tall your grass is. You might have to pay a fine because you left your garden hose out in the yard overnight. And yet they will talk to you about how free they are. If a man is enslaved and yet believes he is free, he has no chance of ever attaining freedom because he will never seek it. A traditional slave understood that he's in servitude, but his contract runs out after so many years, or perhaps the master has told him, if you do a good job in 5 years, I will give you an allotment of a few animals and you can go ahead and be free. I do this for all my slaves that work hard. And you understand your position. But a man who believes he is free while he is enslaved will never seek freedom because he believes he already has it. He's never going to seek to better himself. He's never going to seek to untangle himself from the chains that have bound him down. He's enslaved by a lie. We enslave ourselves with the lies we tell ourselves. Much of this society is structured around embracing sin. You know, we have a whole month dedicated as a religious holiday to celebrate sodomy. That's a reality of America. We got to save America, that we knew when we have an entire month dedicated to sodomy, celebrating it. When people are encouraged to define themselves, you know, by sin. In other words, how do I want to put this? Oh, well, that's just who I am. The moment you give up, the moment you say, well, it's just, this is a part of who I am. This defines my very being. You're never going to seek to be outside of that, to move on beyond that. And you look at this society and it's structured to encourage people. You notice they don't encourage people to be more upright. There's not a month where we celebrate the righteous. We don't have a month where we celebrate those who strive to do the work of God. We don't have a month where we celebrate those who truly seek the Lord and perform actual acts of charity and good works. You see, the society is structured to keep people internalizing, to lie to themselves, to embrace sin, so that they don't ever try to move on from it. Again, the lie keeps people enslaved. The way this entire society, and it goes beyond that blatant example, the way the entire society is structured. One of the things I find interesting talking about slavery is you've heard the term wage slave. Wagey for short. You know, being a wage slave. And there's so much truth to that. When you really think about it, and I realize virtually every one of you listening probably has a job. I'm not ridiculing you for that. You have to survive. This is how the society is structured. What I am criticizing is the way the society is structured. You've got to go work. You got to find a way to make a living. And for most people, that entails some sort of job. And yet I find it curious, just interesting on an intellectual basis, how people believe that being enslaved by choice to an employer is somehow different than someone selling themselves into indentured servitude. If back in the olden days, you sold yourself for a period of 4 years into servitude to cover your debts because you got into debt, or maybe you just went broke and you don't have any money for food and shelter and you're in trouble. So your last option is to sell yourself into slavery for a period of, say, 4 years to somebody. And, you know, as a part of that deal, that person's got to provide you. You know you're going to have food, you're going to have shelter, you have a place to live, you know, and you're going to work. Where in this society, it is structured to where the average person goes and works their ass off all day, 6, sometimes 7 days a week. 5 if you're lucky, but those days are going by quickly. Now it's 6 days. Some people work weeks before they see a day off. And as far as your food and your shelter, clothing and such, you're on your own for that. If they don't pay you a living wage, if after you pay for your rent, you don't have any money left over for food and clothing, that's your job to figure out. Your employer has no obligation. It is no different than the slave-master relationship. It's just been given a different rhetorical dress to put on. It's just dressed up rhetorically different. But when you get down to the brass tacks of it, you're a slave. You're a wage slave. Now, you can choose it. You can quit your job and sign on with another slave master, but there is always going to be that slave-master dynamic. If you live, you'll always understand that. Well, you need to take off to, say, go to the doctor. You need to take off because you have a sick child at home and you got to stay home and take care of them. You have to go. You know that feeling. We've all had it. You got to go to your employer with your hat in your hand, basically. I really need to take a couple of days off. My child is sick. I have nobody to watch after him. And you always know there's that feeling because they're going to flex on you. They get, well, this really puts us out. You know, this is a busy time of the year for us. And we really need you here. Do you not have? You see, because you have that feeling when you have to go to your boss, beg for a day off. As if the time in your life was gifted to you by them instead of God Almighty. You know that feeling of anxiety because you know there's always that very real possibility they're going to flex on you. And then if they do eventually say, okay, you can go and take off. Never mind that for most people, he's not paying you to be off. It isn't like he's doing you a favor, but they make you think they're doing you a favor. They're not even paying you. You know, and you've been late for work a couple times this week, you get chewed out, maybe written up. How dare you be late, even though you haven't clocked in. It's not like it's costing them money. But you see, there's always that dynamic. The problem isn't that you're costing them money because you are not. The problem is they want to make sure that it is an effort to reinforce the slave-master relationship. You don't forget your place. You don't forget who you are and who I am. You're the slave, I'm the master. Now, for most people with their jobs, and we're gonna get back on this here in a minute. I'm kind of getting off on a tangent, but one of the humorous things is most of the time at your job, the person you're dealing with is a manager or somebody. And a funny thing to keep in mind, as that person is flexing on you, he's not actually a master either. He's just a higher up slave. You know, a manager, he's just a slave too. He just thinks he's somebody. Now, to reel this back in to make the point that I was actually going to make, all of this, because you work so much, because this is the way the society is structured, because you work so much, people simply do not have the time to seek God. They don't. I'm sorry, 1 hour on Sunday sitting down in a church somewhere doing 30 minutes of singing entertainment and 30 minutes of hearing a preacher is not anywhere near enough. I mean, I applaud any effort anybody makes. You know, you got to do what you got to do. But in reality, it's not enough. But there are only so many hours in a day, and that's the reality. You know, you've got to eat. You got to be able to pay your bills. You have shelter and all of your necessities. And so for the average person, that means you've got to work. And there's no time to seek the Lord. I don't believe that's by happenstance. I believe this is a part of the intentional construction of the society that we live in to make sure. Now, on the one hand, not only do they encourage people to stay in sin, to embrace it as who they are, as an identity, and say that you shouldn't even attempt to change yourself for the better. You need to embrace who you are. On the other hand, they make sure that you don't, even if you decide to do better, even if you decide to try to get closer to God, even if you decide you want to seek the truth and the Lord and understanding in the Lord, you haven't got time to do it anyway. Even if you want to. That is the way this entire society has been constructed. And of course, it's all constructed by a lie, and it keeps people enslaved. You think of you, many of you probably familiar, you know, if you look into like, you know, middle-aged peasants, you know, they're out there farming their little plot of land and oh my gosh, they were so backwards, but they also had tons of free time. I mean, yeah, they were busy, really busy and worked really hard during certain parts of the year, but then they also had a lot of free time when those parts of the year were done. And they had time to seek the Lord. They had time to do things and to think about things. Nobody has time for that anymore. People out there working 2-3 jobs sometimes just try to scratch by. When are you going to fit in time? Seek the Lord. Yeah. And I mean, it just is how it is. I'm not criticizing people for having to live this way. It's just the way you got to live. It's one of the things I find it an honor and a blessing to share whatever, you know, insights I have in these matters with you, because I realize most all of you don't have time. You just don't have time. So, you know, if I read from the book of Matthew and it's like, oh, wow, there's something I really find insightful in the Lord, you know, I share it with y'all because I understand y'all don't have time. You know, at least you can hear it and you can maybe spend a few minutes, you know, reflecting on it and pondering. You hear the information at least. Because I get it. Look, I get it. There's only so many hours in the day, and you've got to make a living. It's the way this entire society, it's an unnatural form of way of living. But we're not going to be in denial. We understand that's simply the world we live in. Now, I said I wanted to get into Matthew 25. Obviously, I'm not going to sit here and read all of Matthew 25. If you have time and you're so inclined, you might pause the show. This is one of the great things about this format that we have, this podcasting format. You can pause whether you're listening on the site or whether you've downloaded it and you're listening on your device. You could pause here and read Matthew 25 before we get into the discussion. Now, like I said, I'm not going to read Matthew 25. It would take too long, and it's very difficult to sit there and listen to somebody drone on and read. However, what is in Matthew 25, most of you are familiar with these parables, but you know, you can go back and refresh yourself. We don't have time for me to sit here and read it out. But Jesus is the entire chapter is Jesus speaking, and he's laying out these various parables, this likening. What is the kingdom of God like? And he gives these examples. And again, most of you are familiar with the examples. He gives the example, for instance, of the 10 virgins who are waiting for the bridegroom. They're waiting for the groom to show up. And he's late in coming. 5 of them are wise and say, well, you know, at the beginning of this, they're like, we don't know when this guy's coming, so we better get us some extra oil for our lamps, because their duty is to light their lamps and go out there and meet the bridegroom to be taken in to the wedding. The other 5 just had their lamps. We're waiting. Well, obviously, in the parable, the bridegroom is late in coming. He comes late in the night. And then the call comes out. He's here. He's arriving. He's on his way. We can see his caravan a-coming. And the girls all jump up and light up their lamps. Well, the 5 that didn't bring extra oil are like, oh my gosh, we're out of oil. We waited, and now we don't have any oil. And they tell the ones that brought extra oil, give us some of yours so we'll have some oil. And the ones that had the extra oil said, we can't do that. There's not enough for all. None of us will have oil for our lamps if we do that. We have just enough with the extra we brought. You're going to have to go find somebody that's selling oil real quick and try to get your oil before he gets here. They do this, but they don't make it. The five that were prepared meet the bridegroom, go inside, and the door's closed. The other five who went out to get oil, they run up there, and they're late. They're banging on the door. "We're here, we're here." And he says, "Be gone. I don't know who you are." They're locked out. We don't know how much time we have. Most people mistakenly, and y'all, I've talked about this to the point you're sick of hearing it, I'm sure, but most people always think of the day of the Lord as someday when Jesus comes in the clouds of heaven. And yeah, but only the people that are alive at that moment will see that in that context. But the day of the Lord comes whenever you leave this world, because you step out of time and you're there. You're there when he's arriving and ripping the veil of time off of this existence. You step out of the temporal realm into the eternal realm. You step out of time. The day of the Lord is here for you now. So in other words, it's coming. We don't know. You notice in the parable, the bridegroom is going to show up. It's not like he stood him up. He was coming. The healthiest way to look at the day of the Lord is the day that you die. While it is possible Jesus could rip the veil of time off this world while you're alive and breathing on the earth, the statistical odds are the day of the Lord is going to come when you yourself exit this realm, but you will see it in that very moment. Because once you leave this world, once you die, your time to do what you need to do is over. That's it. If you're out of oil, you're out of oil. There ain't no time to run. Now, we don't know how long we got. You know, you go through your life and you think you got plenty of oil for your lamp. Now, death can come upon you quickly. The day of the Lord can come upon you quickly. And before you know it, there you are. Sometimes you might get some warning. They might say, the doctor might say, you got cancer, you got 3 months to live. Now, you've lived your whole life in vanity, chasing after frivolous things, meaningless things. But now that doctor says you got 3 months to live. Now you're running around trying to buy oil. You had a whole lifetime to get prepared, to do what you needed to do. And now, you running around trying to get oil in 3 months. There ain't enough time. You can do what you got to do. I get that. But understand, the time you spend ain't coming back. The wise virgins, they built up their oil. They got ready. They understood. We don't know. Don't know. Could be right now. He could show up right this minute, or it might be a long time coming. We need to be building up some oil. We got to have some reserves. Live your whole life doing whatever the hell you want to, indulging in whatever earthly things, focused on worldly things. And then the doctor says, "Well, you got 3 more months left." All of a sudden, your lamp is out, and you don't have no extra oil. You can't go back. You wasted the time. Now you're running around trying to do all of these things in the last 3 months. Ain't got no oil. Another parable Jesus tells in Matthew 25 is one I've referenced quite a bit. And that's the three servants that were entrusted. One was given 5 talents. One's given 2, and one servant is given 1. The 3 servants, you know. And when the master is long in returning, he comes back, and the one that had the 5 talents, was entrusted with 5 talents of money, says, "Look, I've turned your 5 talents, you know, because the master calls them in." They get called up. First one comes in. "Hey, I gave you 5 talents of money. What'd you do with it?" He said, "Look, here's your 5 talents plus another 5 talents. Now you got 10. You did well." The one that was given 2 is brought in. He says, "What have you got to show for it?" "I took this 2 talents. Notice the servant that was given 2 talents isn't miffed. I was only given 2. He took the 2 and he says, "Look, I've turned it into 4. I've doubled it. I brought some profit. I put some effort in. your good and faithful servant. And of course, you all know the third guy who simply buried it in the ground, put no effort in, comes in and says, here's your one talent back. I kept it safe for you. There it is. That's what you gave me. That's what you're getting back. He's cast out with the evildoers. He said, you could have put it out to the usurers and at least made some interest on it. You could have done something. You just buried it in the ground and went about your business. He says, take whatever he has and give it to the one that had the five, that now has the ten. See, he that had just that little bit, he's not even getting anything now. And finally, he likens the kingdom of God to gathering up the sheep and the goats and separating them, one on the one side and one on the other. One batch is going to hell. Not that God has a resentment against goats, but that's just the illustration given. The sheep on one side, the goats on the other. One's going to hell, one's going to the kingdom of God. And he says, because these people are protesting, and they say, you know, which is bad. He says, you know, how come? And he tells the sheep, I'll spit it out here in a minute. You know, he tells, well, he says, I was hungry. I was naked without clothing. I was sick. I was in prison. And you came and ministered to me. And they're like, when did we ever see you like that? We don't know what you're talking about. I mean, and he says, anything you've done for the least of these, you know, you put this effort in, and anytime you did this for the least of these, you also did it unto me. You did it for me. You know, yes, it wasn't literally me that was sick and in prison and you came and ministered to me, but you did do it for one of mine. And so it's the same as doing it for me. And likewise, the ones that are destined for damnation, they get told the same thing. You didn't do any of these things. And they protest and say, we never saw you in that situation. We would have totally done it for you if we knew it was you. And he says, that which you didn't do for the least of these, you also didn't do for me. Notice the focus and the emphasis on action, on what did you do? You know, there's always this story. You can go into any church and they'll talk to you about salvation by faith in Jesus, but they don't ever tell you what that faith is. And yet Jesus spells out what the faith is. What are you doing? I find this, the reason I wanted to talk about the entire chapter 25 is because these three examples, he likens the kingdom of heaven to these three examples. And it just makes sense that they're more or less the same example. The 10 virgins, 5 wound up being prepared, 5 were unprepared. But what does that mean? Well, you fast forward to what we just talked about here, just referenced here, and he tells you, what did you actually do? You know, I don't understand. What is oil in the lamps? What does oil in the lamps have to do with anything? He tells you right here, what did you actually do? Elsewhere, Jesus said, if you really love me, you'll follow my commandments. You'll do what I've told you to do. It's not a mystery. He's very clear what faith is. Yes, your faith saved by your faith, but it's not empty emotionalism. It's action. He tells you right here. Here, he lays out very clearly. These that are destined for the kingdom of God, they took action. In other words, they had faith. They had faith. They put the effort in. Their faith was demonstrated by their deeds. They're not saved by the deeds themselves. They're saved because they acted in faith. They acted. These others didn't do a damn thing. Just like the third servant. See, it's the same parable, just told in a different way. The third servant didn't do anything. He didn't steal the one talent, but he didn't do anything. He just buried it. We're admonished elsewhere. Jesus says, nobody lights a lamp and then hides it under a basket. You do something with it. What did you do? The king calls the three servants in one at a time. Okay, what have you done? I've done this for you. Now, what do you got to show for it? It doesn't matter if you were given 1, 2, or 5. What matters to the king, look, he's a king. 5, 10 talents of money is nothing to him. It's not about the money. What you were entrusted with, what you've got, what do you have to show for it? Well, I did this. You know, you note that the servant that was just given two, he's praised on the same level as the one who was given five. Because he did something with what he had. He was given less. He didn't admonish him. He didn't say, how come this other guy has 10 talents of money? How come you only have four? Because he knows he wouldn't give him five to start with. It's not fair. He only started with two, and he did really well by doubling it. He would have been praised if he turned the two into at least three, at least demonstrating he took some action. He put some effort in. The only one condemned is the one that took the one and just ignored it, just buried it and went about his business. Didn't take any action, no effort on his own part. The king says, you could have just put it in the bank and drew interest. You would have something to show for it. But he didn't even do that. Couldn't be bothered. You see, these three parables ties everything together. The 10 virgins waiting for the groom to show up. You know, five are prepared, five are not. But what does that preparation mean? This references the limited time you have. What does this action mean? The three servants given three different amounts to invest with different varying results. But what is the investment? What does this represent? And then the final, where he explains, what actions did you take? You know, what part of my work did you do? What effort did you put in for my sake in faith? Not because there was something. You go and, you know, in the example given here, you're going and tending to the sick or tending to those who are unjustly imprisoned. You're going and doing these things. You saw me naked and gave me clothing. It requires having the ability. It means you had the ability to do that. You know, if you're walking around in rags yourself and you ain't got a pot to piss in and you see someone else walking around in rags and got a pot to piss in, Lord isn't holding you responsible because you didn't have it to give. The implication here is you had a way to do something and you didn't do it. You know, you had the ability, but didn't want to. Now, if you go and, you know, you go and do these things, minister, as the example given here is, you know, there's nothing in it for you per se. This is part of the investment. If you're just getting paid back, if you say, well, I'll loan you these clothes and you can pay me back, well, you got your reward there. You got what you were. The whole idea is you're doing something that's not necessarily going to benefit you in this world. You're investing in the kingdom of God. Does that make sense? You're investing in the kingdom of God, going and ministering to the sick. That there's no payoff for you in this world. You're doing it by faith. You're doing it by faith. We could go on. We're running long here. We're going to run long. I need to wrap it up because I could keep going. I'm so tempted now to leap from there into when Jesus warned those who, you know, seek, you know, do their charity out, slinging it around, bragging about it so that men will praise them. Got their reward already. We could keep going. We got to stop. I hope you take the time to read through Matthew 25 and kind of think about how these are the same parable told in a different way. This illustration he's given so that everything, if you look at the three together, then it all ties together and makes sense. So I hope you get the time maybe to read it and think about it from this point of view. But like I say, we've got to wrap it up. I really appreciate you joining me today. I hope you got something out of the whole show. We always have a fun discussion here, especially primarily out of our Christian specific segment. So we'll wrap up on that note. I hope you'll get a chance to check out the rest of our content up on Radio Alvin for the rest of the week. And of course, I hope to see you here next week for the Parish of the Patriots.